What you're about to listen to is a very early recording of the 4F Film Review Podcast featuring myself, Shay, and my good friend, Eric. This episode was recorded before we had hosting, chemistry, on-mic skills, or even a proper name for the podcast. Please keep all of these things in mind and try to excuse any audio or flow issues that may occur as a result of listening to two bozos talk about movies and cut their teeth in the realm of podcast production. I guarantee you that it will at least be more entertaining than all of those podcasts hosted by celebrities that are neither funny nor interesting. Enjoy. Everybody, welcome to Eric and Shay Watch Movies, now with gear.
Yeah, we like actually feel like we might record something that doesn't sound terrible.
That people might want to listen to?
That maybe.
That you can listen to.
Yes.
Whether you want to.
Something listenable is more important than necessarily the content, but like just that you have some slop going into your ears that you find agreeable enough to continue to let it flow, you know?
There are podcasts that sound worse than us that have better content.
Absolutely.
So if those podcasts can survive, then surely us with our great sounding voices can also survive.
Yeah, I mean, there's a marketplace for everything.
So I'm Shay. Eric is the other person. We are recording this podcast primarily so that we can attempt to monetize our friendship. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, I mean, as we will probably explore at some point in time through other films, like everything in this world should be monetized.
We'll definitely explore
value on. Right?
Yes, we'll explore that. And so we're watching movies. We're watching good movies.
Sometimes
it's more entertaining to watch bad movies.
Yes, definitely.
We watched Armageddon today.
We're all the worse for it.
1998's Armageddon, to be clear, with Bruce Willis and Billy Bob Thornton and Ben Affleck.
Yeah, if you're a certain age, there's no way you don't know about it because you heard 80 million commercials in the summer of 1998 that were all playing "Don't Miss a Thing" from Aerosmith, and that's what we watched.
So you say that, but you had not seen this movie. Now I was 5 years old when this movie came out. You were like 20.
Yeah, no, I was 17 years old.
Okay.
Really?
I was trying to over-exaggerate, but I didn't miss the mark by that much.
This came out, I was 17 years old. I was not yet, I was going to be going into a senior year of high school, and I was working, so I had disposable income and a car, so I was able to go see movies.
But you didn't go and see this movie.
I did not see this movie because I was too cool to go see.
You were too cool to see the Michael Bay $140 million budget summer blockbuster Armageddon, starring as your main antagonist a giant meteor the size of Texas hurtling towards the Earth 65 million years after the one that wiped out the dinosaurs, Eric.
Correct. And I am glad that they introduced the film with the idea that, you know, a big rock could kill all of us just like the dinosaurs. You know, that set the proper emotional tone for the marathon we were about to endure.
Oh, marathon is right, dude. This movie was 2.5 hours long.
Yeah.
That is so long a movie of this quality.
It was mind-boggling. I remember I told you last week when we were plotting to watch this that it's 156 minutes runtime, and you were like, what? And then I reminded you of it again this morning, and
my reaction was probably identical.
Yes,
exactly.
You were outraged and astounded both times.
My wife is in the background doing some myriad chores around the house, and I don't think it's coming through on the mic, but she may chime in at some point with her thoughts on this movie, because
she has contributions possibly to make as well to this atrocity, because she was alive during 1998.
She was alive and getting abused by her. That's not a joke, I guess. That she was abuse is maybe a little bit strong, but she was traumatized by the impact that this movie had on her young impressionable mind. We're first time podcast. There may be some weird cuts. Maybe you just heard one.
Yeah, maybe. This film stars Bruce Willis and what is a then young Ben Affleck, who. You were astounded that it was Ben Affleck because he didn't look all
Well, he wasn't wearing a big mask, you know.
He didn't have his Barry Bonds regimen.
There were no batarangs.
Yes, and no, none of that stuff.
And
either.
Introducing a very young, in their first role, Giant Asteroid.
Yes.
Who was really, again, main antagonist. You have to recognize the contribution.
But he would get, you know, other roles down the line that you, I'm sure, would recognize him from.
He ran for president a couple times. I saw the bumper stickers.
It's Big Asteroid is,
we're getting laughs from the other part of the room.
You can't ignore him when he's in the room. He's undeniable.
All right, so this movie sucks, and I don't think we need to really belabor that point, because anyone who's listening to this, we should back up and say, if you haven't seen Armageddon, I don't know why you're listening to this, but yeah, you should probably go...
Well, no, there are people who are bad movie voyeurs out there who haven't seen a film, but they know it's bad. And maybe they want to hear,
and they just go and listen to podcasts
all the reasons
about
why this is terrible. Because if we're doing it entertainingly enough, you know, because like, all right, you know, a dumb summer blockbuster like this is. It was released right before July 4th. You know, this is supposed to be a popcorn film that you take out the family.
Dude, you'd be out
or
of
your
popcorn.
Girlfriend,
you'd
too.
Be out of popcorn 90 minutes in, because you'd just be like, man, I can't. Like, it's just, there's nothing. I don't know what to do with my hands. I'm sitting here, well, and I'm just waiting for anything of any impact to happen whatsoever.
Yeah, the problem is that, you know, like a film like this, it should be ideally three acts and 90 to 100 minutes top. But this, instead, once we got to about an hour in, I noted that we were at the end of the what seems like the second
we
act.
We were still on Earth an hour into this, Eric.
We were at what should have been the end of the second act. They like had launched into space. Because it's like Act 1 is like introducing them to the problem. Act 2 is they learn to be astronauts. Act 3... they're flying through space and landing on the asteroid. Act 4, they're drilling through the asteroid. And then Act 5 is, how do we blow this thing up?
Right. And you did skip over the part where they were on the space station with the Russian guy, too.
Well, yeah, that's part of... That's part of Act 3.
That's the beginning of Act 3.
Yeah, that's right between 2 and 3, or beginning Act 3, yes. The one redeemable character in the entire film, Lev. Russian astronaut. Everybody else is, you know, very disposable, but Lev has some personality. He's been stuck up on the Russian space station for 18 months, which...
Alone.
Yeah, alone. He's the only person up there, and, you know, he knows how everything works, though, and he's a Russian hero, which he proceeds to demonstrate throughout the remainder of the film.
The way that you explained all of that so quickly was much more effective than the movie's way of doing it, too.
Yeah,
I feel like with the amount of exposition this movie has setting all this stuff up, I definitely feel as though... I mean, how much of this movie could have been cut just from, like, an exposition standpoint?
Yeah.
Hate to keep harping on the length thing, but my God, 2.5 hours is long for an action movie like this.
Yeah, Jerry Bruckheimer is still collecting the same amount of dollars at the end of the day. And yeah, Michael Bay really fought for every last scene. He thought they were all essential. He didn't want to cut anything.
What's funny is that,
you
like,
don't want to miss a thing. He was listening to the song while he was in the editing room, and he just fired the editor, shot them through an airlock.
In a lot of ways, you could say that that song was the inspiration for this movie from the beginning. Like, they wrote the song, like, we have to make a movie about this. I know.
It's
Giant Asteroid. Don't want to miss a thing. It's going to destroy the entire Earth.
Even,
it's not going to miss
even
a thing.
All the flat performances. Sorry, Liv Tyler. I don't believe that you love Ben Affleck, or that you're really conflicted that much. And you should not have been in Mission Control that whole time. Oh gosh, so many things don't make sense.
Well, I mean, this is not the first podcast that we've recorded. This is the first one we are releasing to all of you lovely people. And we watched the program last week with the intention of doing a show about it. And the entire time during this college football movie, I kept commenting to Eric, like, this is taking me out of it. This is taking me out of it. This is really inaccurate. They wouldn't do it this way. This movie took that and multiplied it times 20.
Yeah, yeah.
There's so many things that just you... The movie is constantly asking you to suspend your disbelief, and you just can't do it because it just keeps ratcheting up the ridiculousness.
Yeah, there were at least 10 to a dozen times that Ben Affleck's character should have died, but he also happens to be super competent at things, you know. There was a subtle undertone that we were noting as we were watching it about how this movie like valorizes blue collar workers and how the oil drillers are way more important and smart and effective at saving humanity than those egghead intellectuals.
I'm really surprised there was not a reference to egghead intellectual, like, as a phrase. Like, nobody at any point said, shut up, stupid science jerk! You know, like, nobody ever did that, but it felt like it was on the tip of its tongue.
There is a pretty anti-intellectual, anti-science aspect to the movie overall.
Ironically, for a movie about shooting dudes into space, they were really simplifying things quite a bit.
How are we introduced to Bruce Willis's character? He is hitting golf balls off of an oil platform at a Greenpeace boat.
Hey, do you know how much diesel that boat pumps out every second?
Yeah, I know. They're very big hypocrites.
Anti-science Greenpeace scumbags.
Yes, I know. They don't believe in the kind of progress that we need with fossil fuels that are, you know, harvested by good, hardworking blue-collar guys like... You know, Sex Pest, played by Steve Buscemi, or Bruce Willis, the best driller on the face of the earth.
They named him at one point like he's the best at what he does. Like yes, Harry Steinberger, whatever his name is. Harry Stamper is his name.
Yes,
that's a blue collar name. Oh, Harry Stamper Oil. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, we could go and talk about like every individual thing the movie did wrong along the way, like while introducing the characters, because we're not going to go on this podcast like point by point and talk about all the plot points of the movie. But like there are certain things that I feel like are unavoidable. The way that all of these characters were introduced as like, OK, they're all here on this oil rig. Now they're all going to go back to where they came from and do their thing that these characters, these one dimensional characters do. And then all of a sudden we're just going to bring them all right back into this like group. It made absolutely no sense. And it just did nothing but to set every single character in this movie up as the most one dimensional subplots to this movie's big dumb A plot.
Yeah, and yes, everyone has their little contribution of quote unquote character, but everybody's so one note that none of them are memorable.
Let's count them off. You said Sex Pest, Steve Buscemi.
Yeah, that's the one that's most distinctive.
Yeah,
there's
a strange dad whose name I don't remember.
Yeah, there's
Liv Tyler.
Yeah, Liv Tyler.
All right, who has no personality whatsoever except for being a woman. That is her primary personality trait.
There's the large, strong driller guy.
The guy with the wrench at the beginning? Yes. Whose name is Bear, because of course it is.
Correct, of
And also,
course.
Also, I mean, not to, you know, I don't want to get into this, but like token black character, right?
Correct.
Like, you have to have
yes,
one.
Yes.
There is Harry Stamper himself, whose only personality trait is, I am the best at what I do, and I don't want my daughter... dating anybody,
yeah,
I guess.
Who introduces our last character, who is AJ, who we just... It's Ben Affleck.
Yeah,
And he doesn't really have any character other than, you know, in love with Liv Tyler. That's his character. And we're supposed to care about that because he's like a guy who's in love. So if his
dude, I've been in love. I can connect with him. I was in love once. And then I went into space and everything changed.
How many times was your life threatened?
Like two.
Two? Okay, yeah. Well, it wasn't broadcast to, like, a summer audience.
Well, no, dude, we were dark for like half of the time. It was the rotation was off, so like we couldn't communicate. All the important stuff happened while we were dark, because of course we came back and everybody was dead, and they're like, "What happened?" And I'm like, "You'll never know. I'll never tell you."
Yeah, yeah. For the listeners here, he was imparting some of the high level science concepts of, oh, wait, you know, we're going to be out of radio transmission for these couple of minutes. And yes,
this is an example of like the real science that the movie actually did attempt to deploy, but it wasn't actually done in a way that sounded remotely scientific.
No. It's one of those things where it's a dumb guy's version of something a smart guy would think.
Yes.
Which is a trope of like summer blockbuster type of films. And
well, you have to be able to communicate it to a mass audience, right?
Yeah, like, which, I mean, I understand that a certain bit, but it also, it just compounds the stupidity to certain levels.
What it results in is us sitting here 15 minutes into a big, dumb summer blockbuster movie with a bunch of the intellectual types all sitting in a room together, and the smartest guy, the self-proclaimed smartest guy in the room, says, "Imagine you were holding a firecracker in your hand. You'd blow your hand off and your wife would be opening your ketchup bottles for the rest of your life," instead of actually saying anything that sounds remotely scientific. It's like, it's the whole thing is just, it's a mess of a movie.
Yeah, it's all over the place, and I didn't see who the editor was for this.
Here, I'll look this up.
Keep
talking.
But there must have been blackmailable material on him, or he was just fired midway through, or just told, no, you are not allowed to do your job because, I do not understand at all how this film ended up what it is.
Three editors. Three voices.
Okay, no, that explains it then. Because, okay, you've got multiple voices, but also dude's got fired halfway through.
Mark Goldblatt did editing on Terminator 2, of course. We have Glenn Scantlebury, who has edited Transformers, so he's worked with Michael Bay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm presumably off the strength of this awesome movie.
Right, yeah, he might have been the last guy, that means.
And then we have, this is interesting, then we have Christopher John Lebenzin, who is an editor who worked on Crimson Tide, which I referenced during the movie as like, wow, it would be really great if they were able to capture some of the tension Crimson Tide was able to capture.
The first and last guys, those are the first two editors. Those are guys who Michael Bay hired because they had worked on summer blockbusters before, and they probably told him, there's a whole bunch of crap here that we should just remove, and Michael Bay probably got offended and, like, fired him.
We should be clear that we're speculating.
We are totally speculating, but this is how like, things happen.
This is Hollywood, baby. Yeah. This is a Hollywood movie.
Hollywood insiders. We're both kind of from California at some point or another.
I mean, I was literally born there and spent 24 years of my life there.
I lived there for a dozen years, so I basically know it too, even though neither of us lived anywhere near the film industry.
I was 3 hours away from Hollywood. I might as well have been in the backyard.
Films were shot in the Bay Area, so, you know, that's kind of the same thing, right?
Yeah.
Right.
We're Hollywood.
I mean, The Room was filmed there. You haven't seen The Room yet.
No, but we should probably watch that too.
Oh my God.
Stay tuned for upcoming. I'll probably append something to the end of this, Eric, where I announce to our audience the movie we're going to watch next week once we decide, so that I can say, and if you want to watch Stop or My Mom Will Shoot with us, you can do so.
It might be Stop or My Mom Will Shoot.
It should be Stop or My Mom Will Shoot, because
it seems pretty ripe for it. I haven't seen it since I was young.
Oh, you've seen it?
I've seen, at least I've seen most of it in parts, like when it was like broadcast on cable or whatever.
Right. I mean, that definitely seems like the type of movie you would watch in parts on cable.
Yeah, yeah.
Much like the program, which I think we said last week.
Right, yes, yes. There's definitely films that fall into that range from the late 80s to early 90s that were just like, they were cheap enough to be rebroadcast by cable networks and got a sort of ubiquitousness.
So one of the other quirks about this podcast is we're probably not going to spend the entire time talking about this movie, and I've already spent so much of my mental energy this afternoon thinking about Armageddon, I kind of don't want to anymore if I don't have to.
No, but...
So there may be other topics.
Yes.
Do we have another topic?
Yeah, we do. Now, as earlier noted, don't want to miss a thing from Aerosmith.
I don't want to talk about that either.
We don't need to talk about that. Okay. That song. But it is a bad song.
Yeah.
And we also get Sweet Emotion as well. In one of our earlier recordings, we discussed the phenomena known as butt rock.
Okay. Yeah, so let's talk about butt rock.
Yeah. Now, what originally got me into thinking about this was I noticed that the 45th anniversary of AC/DC's Back in Black coming out had happened. AC/DC is a band that in particular, and starting at that time, the early AC/DC with Bon Scott, that's pretty good, but once you get Back in Black, it's just dumb rock. You've got I can't
big remember. Riffs,
yeah,
big songs that sound like something but really are basically like that entire album is just a sex album.
Yeah,
there's nothing going on lyrically or creatively that you'd be like, wow, that's quite a statement they're trying to make there. That's fine, but that is a primary tenet of butt rock.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, and also it's definitely its main aimed at the mass audience. Like they're trying to get as many people to react to these songs. I mean, Back in Black is a top 10 all-time selling album. Like it is popular. Because people respond to
butts.
To butts, yeah.
I mean, and it's, you know, just... and they're right to do so. But, like, I mean, look at the... I could probably name, like, half the songs on that album. I don't have it in front of me. I don't own Back in Black. I don't love this album. But it's so ubiquitous that you just know that's the album with Hell's Bells and Shoot to Thrill and You Shook Me All Night Long.
And other sex references.
Yes, they're all basically like that. Well, Hell's Bells isn't sexy. Hell's, that's about hell.
Yeah.
It's like Highway to Hell,
and
but
Back
it's...
in Black itself is only...
Oh, yeah, Back in Black is also on that record.
Yes.
If you can believe it.
Yes. We've been thinking about this and, like, how far do the boundaries of butt rock go? Like, because there's definitely, like, later butt rock is things like Nickelback and Creed and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But butt rock goes back even further.
Butt rock goes deep.
It does. It goes deep. Like, I mean...
You can go deep into the annals of butt to find... The nuggets of...
the foundations, yes.
Oh, all right. Take it back to that. Yeah. So anyway, we came up with some examples. And you were saying... Well, I don't want to steal your thunder. What were some of yours?
That's the thing is you've got some bands that actually do have a lot of creative like merit and stuff like that. Like Queen. Queen is a fantastic band. There's a ton of merit to a lot of their music. But then they've got We Are the Champions / We Will Rock You.
I mean, We Will Rock You is the ultimate butt rock anthem.
Because
77, is that right? Well, anyway, the point is it goes back farther than Back in Black. So I started thinking, like, what is the earliest butt rock song?
Yeah.
Like, we kept pushing further and further back.
Yeah, because
like,
there's definitely butt rock into the 60s, too. Like,
would that be? We only I got as far as Grand Funk Railroad and We're an American Band.
Oh, that's
You could go by Free, maybe?
Well, It's
Are we pushing the boundaries of like butt rock versus rock music?
Well, see, that's the thing is like because I did hypothesize and I noted that like Led Zeppelin almost is butt rock but isn't Whole Lot of Love,
but it has Lord of the Rings references.
Not in a Whole Lot of Love, but they do at some point in their catalog, so they are able to have a sheen, a pretentiousness of like, hey, we read a book once. We've read Lord of the Rings. It's in like three of our songs. I know I looked this up. It's like in Ramble On, Battle
Ramble
of
On. That's the song I was thinking of when Yeah, okay, because I was just looking. I was feverishly typing. What are the lyrics to Whole Lotta Love? I'm sure it has the Mordo reference in it. It's a different song.
No. That is in Ramble On.
But here's some lyrics for you. Since I looked them up, I don't want to waste it. Here's Whole Lotta Love, verse one. You need cooling, baby. I'm not fooling. I'm gonna send you back to school. And
yeah,
way
okay,
down inside, honey, you need it.
No. That's Butt Rock. That is Butt Rock. Okay, I would not classify all of Led Zeppelin as Butt Rock, but that is a Butt Rock.
I mean,
tune.
That's brutal. So what are the main things that characterize Butt Rock?
Yes,
right,
it's got a no artistic, like it cannot have any artistic merit at all. Usually lyrically, but I'd say also in terms of instrumentally. Now the other thing is that might keep Led Zeppelin out of Butt Rock is that they have some good musicians.
They do
actually.
Four.
Yeah.
In fact, well, three.
Three, yeah.
And a good singer.
That's,
he was
that,
good.
That's,
Robert
that's,
Plant
that,
was good. Come
I
on.
I mean, he's a prototype for a rock singer. I don't think that he's good necessarily.
We're going to have to deviate on this.
He's got some warbles that go on that are just a little, he's a little much.
Well, yeah, but that is the archetype of a pro rock singer at that time. Like,
he
was very influential.
I understand.
I'm influenced by Robert Plant every day.
I'm glad to know.
I'll do a few bars at the end of the show.
That's good to know. But and similarly, like, okay, so Led Zeppelin, there's maybe some Butt Rock tunes, but they are not Butt Rock.
Not overarching.
So, yeah. Now, similarly, there's probably some The Doors. Break On Through, that is a Butt Rock tune.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, why would you say that?
Because it is not, there's no merit to that song. Like,
you know, the day destroys the night, night divides the day, you try to run, you try to hide, break on through to the other side.
Well, I mean,
that was from memory, by the way.
I'm glad that you...
He can verify this.
I was able to verify it internally within my computer.
Yeah,
brain.
There's nothing there.
There's not really anything
Robbie
there.
Robbie Krieger can play, though.
Robbie Krieger can play guitar, but he isn't doing anything in that song.
Ah, oh, you're right. I don't think he's even...
No.
He's not even in that song.
I mean, he's playing the guitar,
he's got some chords.
He's not doing anything in particular. It's not Light My Fire, which is also...
Well, you bring up the one song that is known for a keyboard solo,
well,
not a guitar solo.
Yes, that's true. Well, no, there is a guitar solo.
Well, yeah, but
that
that's not what people think of
but
with
correct.
That song.
You're correct.
Light My Fire's
but
pretty Butt
Rock. The only things that are keeping the Doors out of full Butt Rock territory are Robbie Krieger could play a kind of cool guitar, and Jim Morrison has this air of pretentiousness. Again, it doesn't have to be he actually knows anything, but he's able to lend this mysticism of like intelligentsia. He did go to college.
He seems like the type of guy who would always wear leather pants.
He went to film school.
Okay.
I mean, that's like...
So
that's,
did Michael Bay. What does that tell you?
He's one of those kind of guys.
Dude, yeah. Speaking of rough way to go, I think that's probably it for us.
Yeah, I know.
We just passed the 30-minute mark. I don't know. We don't want to go...
That I qualify as landing, you know, landing the plane or
landing the space shuttle in this case.
On a asteroid that's flying through space, you know?
It was a rough landing. One of those crews, like half the crew didn't even make it.
Yeah, but we don't care because they didn't actually have any development. So it all works out.
Right. I could not even tell you who died. We missed a character because there was the token, overweight guy. The comedy guy, he died.
Yeah. The dude who you don't remember his names. I don't. His name was Max in the film.
Okay, so why do you remember his name?
I don't remember the actor's name.
Oh.
But I remember recognizing him as token fat dude who's like in the ensemble of the cast in a 90s film.
Yeah. Who has a moment at the end where everyone's like, oh, remember that guy? I liked that guy.
Yeah.
Now he's dead.
But hey, Earth isn't.
Earth survived. And Bruce Willis is a hero. And so are you if you've made it to this point. And I guess that's it, Eric. That's episode one.
Yeah,
this is getting published. So yep. We didn't discuss how we're going to end it, so it'll probably just end.
Yeah, that's about it.